EMSradio.com.
EMS information for the next generation. The EMS Research Podcast is a production of EMSradio.com.
Episode number 9 of the EMS Research Podcast. We're recording this on May 11th, 2011. My name is Harry Mueller, and I'll be one of your hosts. On the panel for tonight's discussion are Tim Noonan. How are you tonight, Tim?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And Bill Toon. How are you, Bill?
I'm doing well. Good to be here, as always, and to talk research. So excellent. I'm ready.
So our topic tonight is the use of fentanyl in pre-hospital pain management. And Tim has agreed to summarize the paper. So, Tim, if you're ready, let's talk about it.
Okay, they were looking at the two major concerns that could be complications with fentanyl use in the out-of-hospital setting, hypotension and hypoxemia. They said that they studied 500 consecutive patients, and this was back in 2006. So this paper has been kicking around for a little while before being published. It was in an Air Medical Service that also has one ground transport ambulance and all ground, air, and even fixed wing transports were included. Took them 4 months to accumulate the 500 patients. They assessed all of the administrations of fentanyl except for those that were included as part of RSI. They also eliminated a bunch of administrations that were given just before arrival at the hospital where they did not have any post-administration, pre-hospital vital signs to document that there was no hypotension or hypoxemia. They did follow up on those and found that in the hospital there was no documentation of any hypotension or hypoxemia in any of those patients. But because they had not collected the vital signs themselves, they excluded those. This included pediatric patients, included geriatric patients, included patients who were already hypotensive. And they found that the biggest indication for post-fentanyl hypotension was pre-fentanyl hypotension, which not terribly surprising, and intubation. So these are probably the sickest of the patients out there. And whether the fentanyl had anything to do with the post-administration hypotension is far from clear. Hypoxemia, on the other hand, they did not find any cases of it. And because of that, there are no subgroups that are suspected of leading to hypoxemia. That is basically it. It's a nice, clear study. There were some questions I had, and I tried to contact the authors, but since it's been a few years, all of them appear to have left Mass General, Brigham and Women's, and Deaconess. So I was able to get in touch with Dr. Thomas, but he was not able to put me in touch with Dr. Krauss, who is the corresponding author. So I was not able to get any clear answers to my questions. Any comments?
Well, I for one, I like this paper a lot. I mean, fentanyl, at least 10 years ago, when we first started talking about it for pre-hospital use, was a taboo medication that was really not even used that much in the ER, at least where I was working. The general feeling was that it was a very dangerous drug for us to be using. And clearly, the results of this study are showing that the things that people were worried about then didn't happen. my read on the paper was that they really didn't have out of those patients didn't have any really bad outcomes from it. I do wish they had been using capnography, and I know the authors did list that as one of the limitations, just because I think capnography would give them a much better picture of what was going on with the patient at that time, rather than watching the pulse oximetry, which sort of gives you an idea of what was going on a couple minutes ago. But by and large, I was really happy with the paper. I thought the results were good. I think for those services that are not using fentanyl pre-hospitally right now, this gives them a big piece of ammunition to go in and discuss this with their medical directors and their pharmacy directors and say, look, this isn't as dangerous a drug as people have been believing. Let's at least study this some more.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you. I think that any medication that we use, I always like the people who says, if you really think about it, we're injecting poison into people. And the other thing I always like to say is that no two people respond the same to medicine, to any medicine that you give them. So I just think it's important that we stay astute and alert and don't become complacent with any medication we administer and use those good tools. And I'm not discounting observing the patient, observing the patient, but using your other tools for patient safety, your pulse oximetry, your EKG, continuous blood pressure monitoring, and I believe that certainly there is the role for end-tidal CO2. End-tidal CO2 will be much more sensitive than your pulse oximetry to begin to pick up any respiratory depression or anything from the patient. Yet I run across a lot of paramedics in our system, even here, and I don't want to say – I don't know. I say a lot. That may be an unfair statement. But I do know that there is a belief that paramedics feel I can get the pain medicine on board. Why do I need to do all of this monitoring for these people? They're healthy and blah, 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 blah. And I really think that from a patient safety point of view, you shouldn't miss the opportunity to monitor these individuals closely. And it's amazing the amount of time I spend in the operating room. They won't do anything to a patient until they're on every monitor they can under the sun and they have their baselines established before they move ahead with what they're doing. And they have far more training than we do in the administration of pain medications or analgesia in general. So that's my two cents.
I agree. When this was added to Pennsylvania's scope of practice, there was a lot of opposition from some of the medical directors. And I talked with the medical director for one county, which was the most progressive in morphine standing orders. And his response to me was, oh, absolutely not. This is much too powerful a drug for EMS. One of the flight programs, they would only use fentanyl in a patient where they could document a controlled airway, which to them meant intubation. So there is a lot of mythology about fentanyl, but we seem to have gone in the other direction with people saying, well, all those scare stories weren't true, therefore we don't have to pay any attention. As Bill was saying, you know, there's this hesitation to use the monitoring devices we have. Waveform capnography is an excellent way of monitoring the respiratory drive of the patient, and we should probably cover some of the studies that have been done on procedural sedation and how that shows that even physicians in the emergency department have trouble identifying hypoxia in the patients undergoing procedural sedation. So there is a lot to be learned from that, even with much more training than EMS has. Also, bradycardia can be one of your clues to an adverse reaction to opioids and to nitrates and to several other medications. And we ignore that when we just put on a pulse ox or blood pressure in the pulse ox and not hook up the heart monitor. this is important information that we can use to determine, have we given too much? Have we room to give more?
Yeah, I'm just going to jump in there. Tim, you're absolutely correct. I think that, you know, let us use our good, astute skills of observation, feeling the pulse, listening to breath sounds. I don't want to discount one bit of the physical assessment that a paramedic should do, but to not use these other tools, these tools that provide objective information, not subjective information, objective information about how a patient is responding or not responding to treatment, I think is the key here. So we use fentanyl here in our system very successfully. I know our paramedics wish we used greater dosing. The maximum dose that we can give on a standing order is 200 mics, and they always talk about wanting to give more. Now, that doesn't stop them from talking to medical control and increasing the amount that they give, but we give our fentanyl, morphine, and Versed is all done without medical control. Once you reach the limits, you, of course, need to be speaking to medical control, and we also do fentanyl intranasally as well as intravenously in cases. So we've had very good, knock on wood, I have to find some that we've had a good safety profile, but we're still trying to really encourage people about the importance of closely monitoring.
Yeah, we've had very good results with fentanyl here in New Hampshire with to my knowledge, very few problems. But I do agree, the monitoring portion, I fail to comprehend why so many paramedics or so many visible paramedics are not interested in performing all the monitoring they can to keep a really good handle on what their patient's condition is. I have a suspicion that's probably a minority of paramedics, but those always seem to be the ones that draw attention to themselves.
And the 80-20 rule or 90-10 rule, the Pareto distribution where 10% of your medics cause 90% of your problems. And that's why they're the ones you notice. They also seem to be the ones who will face the monitor toward the captain's chair and sit behind the patient and just watch the monitor and not watch any of the physical assessments, such as level of consciousness, change in skin color, change in anything that you can observe by assessing the patient, palpation of a pulse, things that you can do much more easily sitting alongside the patient. There was one other thing that's interesting. It's on the second page. It says the median dose of fentanyl per administration was 1.1 micrograms per kilogram, but the range was a quarter microgram to 3.5 micrograms per kilogram. That seems like an awfully high one-time dose.
Yes.
It does, but I think without knowing the specific scenario, you're left to wonder exactly what was going on, and in my mind that makes me wonder if it wasn't being given as a precursor to intubation or as part of a sedation procedure, just because that's an unusual dose for pain management.
Yes,
or there was a medication error.
That is possible. It depends on what size containers they use. The syringes I have are 100 micrograms in 2 milliliters, so I can't make that kind of mistake unless I start throwing syringes over my shoulder because I'm trying to push them so quickly. The total dose, though, was up to a maximum of 3.9 micrograms per kilogram. So that's only 0.4 micrograms per kilogram higher than that one-time dose.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think I'd like to, look into that a little further and look at the tables and see if there's any indication as to where that really high dose came from. If they were administering this medication to a severe burn patient, I could see perhaps needing a larger dose to start with. 3.9 mics, that's still pretty high, but we don't know the scenario. So,
for a total dose, that's at the upper end. The Kanowitz study that they referenced, which they stated was very well done. The only problem they had with it was that it was retrospective. Showed over 2,000 administrations, and their maximum dose on standing orders was 400 micrograms. So depending on the patient, it's probably looking at 4 micrograms per kilogram.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the nice things about that study was they listed a bit more detail about what the vital signs were afterward, and they showed that some of the patients, most of the patients who had low blood pressure before fentanyl had better blood pressure after fentanyl. In this, it's about 50-50.
I was going to state in here is that I would encourage that anyone who's listening to the podcast who currently doesn't have fentanyl as part of their formulary may want to not only look at this study, but look at the studies that are referenced in here. And I think that you could have a very healthy discussion with your medical director to have to be considered this medication as part of your formulary in the future. And again, the thing I think that would really help sell you is to think of patient safety and think of the monitoring expectations that you would have when using this medication. But I do think that it's a nice addition to your formulary, particularly in that borderline patient who would benefit from the hemodynamic stability that fentanyl has over something like morphine or Demerol, where it doesn't have the same potential dramatic effect that some of those other drugs do when it relates to their blood pressure and stuff. So I would strongly encourage looking into this and utilizing this as a way to expand your formulary. I think it's been it's well accepted in the anesthesia as well as the pain management world and sedation stuff. So I think you'll see it, I see it used in the cath labs and just a host of areas. So I think it has great potential if your system's not currently using it.
Oh, indeed. I think some of the other stuff that I would be looking for to bring into my medical director would be a study that talks about the efficacy for actual pain management. I mean, that's outside of the scope of this particular paper. They're not talking about how well it manages pain. They're talking about the incidence of hypotension and hypoxemia, but how well it manages pain is an important factor as well. My experience has been is that the fentanyl is at least as effective as morphine, if not more so, with a faster onset. So I think, that's also another key piece to be bringing to the table for the discussion.
Yeah,
agree.
One of the doctors who participated in the National Association of EMS Physicians discussion about pain management was very much opposed to the suggestion that morphine is slower to work than fentanyl. And there isn't a good study to show a significant difference between them, but the important thing is that fentanyl wears off quickly. That is the important difference between fentanyl and morphine. Even if it doesn't go to work faster than morphine, if you have a complication, it wears off much more quickly. Also, if you have a bumpy ride to the hospital, the patient needs the most pain management during that time when they're bumping up and down on the road or being moved to the ambulance, and not when they're sitting in the much more comfortable hospital stretcher, where they're more likely to have respiratory depression because they are no longer having the kind of painful stimulus to keep them breathing and keep their catecholamines flowing. So it's much safer.
Agreed. I'm going to veer off on a little bit of a tangent here. This is a discussion that we had in the EMS room at one of the hospitals a couple weeks ago, was how many services allow for paramedics to mix medications during patient care? And by that I mean, can they start with fentanyl for immediate pain relief and then switch over to something that's longer lasting during transport? Is that something that either of your services are allowing?
I'll chime in.
Go ahead.
I was just going to chime in and say no. You either start with fentanyl or morphine, but if you want to change or exceed the standing order dose, then you need to speak to medical control. With medical control, you certainly can mix and match, but not without speaking with them.
It's the same for me.
Yeah, that's the same with what we're having. And there was some discussion that people would want to see that changed. And I have to say I'm not 100% comfortable with that idea, that I'm going to move to the dim sum version of pain management, one from column A, one from column B, that sort of thing. But it's something I wanted to ask while I had a couple other areas represented.
Well, a lot depends on your transport times. Where you are, I think it's a much more important option because you want to get the pain managed. You want to use something aggressively to get where you're going, to get the pain where you want it to be. And then for the transport, you might want something longer acting, such as morphine or Dilaudid. And that's not something where I am that is an important consideration, because I generally don't have more than 15 minutes between hospitals, no matter how far out I go. I don't know what it's like where Bill is.
No, that's not an issue. That's also because we're in the largest populated county in the state of Kansas, so we have over 500,000 people here, and in only less than 500 square miles. So it's not an issue for us either. We have relatively short transport time, so it's and I don't see much mixing of the two.
Yeah. If I have more than a 30-minute transport, I've clearly done something wrong. The only medication mixing that we have that's actually allowed in our guidelines is use of nitrous oxide along with the narcotic.
Yeah, we use nitrous here, as well as, you can use nitrous and fentanyl or nitrous and morphine in combination. But speaking of that, we're running into a problem since we cannot find the nitrous oxide units that we carry are no longer manufactured.
Indeed. And I was lucky enough to find a service that was pulling nitrous off of their ambulances, who was agreeable to getting us a few extra units to bring us up to full strength with that. But that's the only way we found them.
Yeah, I'm afraid that nitrous will be leaving our formulary because of our inability to get it. So
that's unfortunate. It's one of those drugs that has been shown to make a significant difference in the amount of morphine that's needed. So for the medical directors who are uncomfortable with morphine, it allows them to write orders, standing orders, that are better for the patient or less likely to cause the patient to be transported in pain without them seeing the more than 2 milligrams of morphine that seems to terrify some medical directors.
I agree with you. It just seems to be what's going to be we're a victim of it. So, pain management, as you said, we're talking about the safety profile that's associated with fentanyl here related to hypotension and hypoxia. It might be worthwhile down the road for us to look at some of the pain management studies that have been done pre-hospitally and delve into them, because they would dovetail nicely with this topic area.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, the Kanowitz study is a wonderful study and might be able to get some of the people from that study to participate. Will and Tom Dunn, I think, were both in it. And as far as I know, Dr. Kanowitz is an interesting guy who would probably want to be on the podcast.
I'd be more than happy to have him on. That would make for an interesting discussion. So it sounds like we've pretty well covered this topic. Any closing comments on this particular paper?
They did have one thing that they said. The safety of fentanyl, as demonstrated in the current study, may be related to more conservative dosing in the unstable patients. But the parallel message is that experienced EMS crews are able to exercise judgment in determining which patient should receive cautious drug dosing. And I think that is the most important thing we need to think about when we're using any of our medications. The quote Bill was referring to is based on the old saying from Paracelsus, all drugs are poisons and only the dose makes the poison. If we educate people in how to assess their patients and when to use caution, when to pay attention to the discomfort that you might feel about using a larger dose and when to just avoid giving a treatment because something just doesn't feel right, that can do a lot more to avoid the complications than just avoiding the use of the drug.
Very good. Bill, any last comments on this?
No, that's exactly the way I feel. I think Tim hit it right on the head there. I just encourage lots of monitoring with any of the pain management we're doing. Patient safety. Always be thinking patient safety, and that's the thing to go. But thank you for having this discussion tonight.
Yeah. I think for me, the take-home message is that fentanyl can be a very safe drug, provided that we do monitor the patient judiciously. And that we match the dosing that we're going to use for the patient's needs, and we're very careful not to be underdosing them and not treating their pain, but also not overdosing them and risking side effects and a potential bad outcome. So thank you both for being here. Bill, where can people find you?
Well, I encourage people to use our Facebook account as a way to contact not only me but all the members of the podcast, as well as you should feel free to also contact me on Facebook for the EMS Educast, the other program that I participate in actively.
All right. Terrific. Tim, where can people get in touch with you?
RogueMedic.com and Paramedicine.com, which are both at EMSBlogs.com. And various podcasts, including here.
Excellent. So you can reach the podcast by going to researchems.com. Look for us on Twitter, EMS ResearchCast. As Bill said, we do have a Facebook page. Search for EMS Research. You can email us, emsresearchcast@gmail.com. Skype us to EMS ResearchCast or call us by phone, 603-397-0367. This has been episode 9 of the EMS Research Cast. Thank you very much for listening.
The best things in life are free. You can keep it for the birds and bees. Now give me money. Now give me money. That's what I want.